All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. You know, Teddy, I had something happen to me last night that I dreamt about, and it's going to happen. It's going to be bugging me all day long, so I got to get this out of my system because I had a dream last night. That's right, I had a dream about Richard Fulton, jazz man, founder, and proprietor of Fifth Street Dicks down in Leimert Park, a man who loved to break the rules and a man who lived by music and by just being out there. And so I just have to say this in what's reported to have been Richard's last words. Teddy, let's go with the spirit of this. Turn the music up! All right, Richard. Miss you, man. All right. Today's show, back into the show. We're going to be talking with Jason Kowalski, who's the policy director of 350.org. And we're going to be talking about climate change, the frying of the planet. Okay, it's not a cooking show, although, boy, that's where it could be going. We're going to be talking about climate change and the Do the Math Tour that's being sponsored by 350.org. And to open the show up, we have a very special section, a very special feature. You know, back a few weeks ago, many of you may have heard a piece of this. It was an interview that Cornel West did with Bob Avakian, and I want to thank the Public Radio International and the Smiley and West Show because they're letting us rebroadcast that interview and broadcasting it in its entirety. And this is an interview that was conducted with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the interview is sharp and wide-ranging, challenging, and inspiring. All right, so without any further ado, let's get into this interview. Take it away, Teddy.
But first, we are joined this week with my dear brother, Bob Avakian. He is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He is a legendary freedom fighter. He's a long-distance runner. He's one of the few coming out of the 60s who never sold out. He never caved in. He never gave up. Held on to his forging of a rigorous scientific analysis of the objective realities that are driven by a revolutionary love, because he has such a deep love for poor people, oppressed people all around the world. And whether you agree or disagree with our brother, one thing you cannot deny, that he is the real thing. No doubt about it. Brother, it's a blessing to have you. Say hello to the audience.
Hello, and thank you very much for that introduction.
No, I'm just telling the truth. So just quickly, let's begin with your reading of our historical moment.
Well, you talked about some of it. I mean, even recent history with the concentration camps and turned Japanese, and today the mass incarceration of youth from the inner cities, of black and brown youth in particular, the little talked about phenomenon of like masses of women in the inner cities being evicted. There's a lot of talk also about people being foreclosed in their homes, but poor women being evicted in growing numbers, as well as growing numbers of poor women going into prison, as the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world in general, and of women in particular. Then there are the wars, there's the poverty, there's the economic crisis, you know, and we could go, and the repression in general, we could go on and on. This is the kind of world we're faced with, where, for example, 10 million children die every year in the third world of malnutrition, and preventable disease. 10 million children every year, more than the population of the biggest city in the United States, for example. And this is the reality that we're dealing with. And the reality is not only that this is horrific, but that it's totally unnecessary. We live in a world of tremendous abundance, but what we have is the private appropriation by a few of this great wealth that's produced by many, and it doesn't go to the benefit of the many. So we need a revolution to radically change this society, but not just this society, the whole world. And we have to change, in fact, the way in which this society, as much as it oppresses people here, the ruling class of the society feasts off the rest of the world and enriches itself on that basis under even worse conditions than what the worst face here. So this is where we stand, and we're up against powerful forces, people that rule this country. I mean, anybody who doesn't recognize how powerful they are doesn't deserve to be taken seriously. Let's just say that straight up. But they're also sitting on top of a system that's erupting underneath them, a system that's riddled with contradictions economically, Politically, they claim that there's liberty and justice for all, but we know that's not true. We know there's profound and widespread injustice. And these contradictions are the basis for how a movement to actually rid humanity of this system can be built.
No, indeed. As you know, I've had a wonderful conversation with Brother Carl Dix.
Right.
Just calling for stop and frisk, Brother Carl Thorne down, and Brother
Leonard. Another outrage.
Oh, Lord, yes. I mean, one distinctive feature of revolutionary communists in the party that you are head of, founder of, is that they tend to accent white supremacy. They tend to accent poor people and their dignity and capacity to change things, but also a scientific analysis of what they are up against. Now, could you tell us just very briefly your conception of revolution vis-a-vis, let's say, Martin Luther King, who called for revolution, wanted a transfer of power from oligarchs to everyday people, recognizing the horror, the misery, the nightmare. But this is important for me, of course, because I'm a revolutionary Christian, you're a revolutionary communist. Could you give us the difference in your understanding?
Yeah, well, let me just add first before getting to that, let's not forget also, and I know you don't, about male supremacy.
And, oh, you
know, one of the great horrors in this world today is the, you know, enslavement of young girls and women in the millions all over the world, including right in this country and right down the street from wherever people are in sexual slavery, as well as other horrific forms of oppression of women and gay people and others in this society, just to get the whole picture flesh it out. And I know you agree with me on that.
Absolutely.
But to speak to the difference in essence is, first of all, Martin Luther King called for a nonviolent change, or the revolution that when he used the word revolution, it was an idea of change that would come about within the existing framework, even if it meant radical change. But what we're talking about is actually breaking the hold of those who rule the society and who prey on the masses of people here and around the world, breaking the hold of their institutions of violent repression over the masses of people. Now, we're not talking about running out and being crazy and trying to do this when there's not a basis for it. In order to have a revolution, you have to have millions and ultimately tens of millions of people who are convinced of the need for that revolution, who are not only fed up and don't want to live another day in this kind of way, but are convinced that there's a radically different way that they could live and that human beings could interrelate and the society and the world could be. And when you get to that point, which is what we're working to bring into being, that kind of consciousness and that kind of political movement and resistance against the crimes of this system, when you get to that point, then you have to be able to deal with the fact that violent repression is going to be brought down on you. These people are not going to step aside. They're not going to say, oh, you're right. You know, we've committed horrible crimes all around the world. We've done terrible things to people. We're going to stop and step aside so you can build a better world. No, they're going to try to violently crush any organized force and broader mass of people who are trying to bring about that change. And you're going to have to deal with their attempts to violently crush it. You're going to have to defeat that. You're going to have to defeat their institutions and their organs of violent repression against people, and you're going to have to dismantle them and replace them with revolutionary institutions that actually serve the radicalization of society in the interests of the great majority of people in the world, and ultimately serving the emancipation of humanity as a whole from this whole horror that we've been living under.
You know, we just had the first debate, and it was a sad spectacle to see the two candidates unable to really engage any of the real issues affecting poor people and working people. Why do you think American society, American culture has been so resistant to the kind of awakening that would lead poor and working people to straighten their backs up, organize, and engage in forms of social activism and resistance that would fundamentally change a society?
Well, I think the people that are vying to be the chief executive and commander-in-chief of this system and its armed forces are trying to enforce the very system and maintain by force the very system that causes all the things that you were just mentioning, and that people need to be organized to stand up against, resist, fight against, and eventually get rid of through revolution. So I think that explains why they talk the way they do and about what they talk about, because their interests are completely different from, but not just different, they're completely opposed to the interests of the great majority of people in this society, and especially those they have their boot on most viciously. So that's one thing. I also wanted to go back, though, not to miss an important element of the previous question you asked, sort of, if you will, the philosophical dimension. What's the difference between a Christian revolutionary and a communist revolutionary?
Yeah.
I know that we want to talk about that. You know, and the difference is that communism proceeds on a scientific basis of actually probing, investigating, and summing up what's learned from reality, and then testing what conclusions you draw from that against reality, so that we can proceed from what is actually arises in reality and what can be verified in reality. And that's our, you know, that's our basic scientific approach, my belief in revolution. And our party's firm foundation in the principles of making revolution is not grounded in the idea that, well, it would just be morally right, although we're profoundly convinced it is morally right, or not just that it would be nicer if the world could be this way, but actually a concrete analysis which leads us to understand in the full dimensions what a horror the world is for the great majority of humanity. If you just think about those 10 million children in the third world, it's just one, you know, concentration of that. What a horror it is, but on the other hand, that it does not have to be this way. And so that we don't base it on, you know, what you've referred to as a prophetic tradition or, you know, religious belief. We base it on a scientific belief, even though it also includes an ethical or moral dimension, that we don't just understand the world as a horror. We also feel that it's intolerable, but we also ground that in a scientific understanding that it does not have to be this way. And the more that you understand scientifically that it does not have to be this way, the more outraged you are by the fact that it continues to be this way and that there are forces who insist upon and use violence to maintain this system and with all the consequences that means for the great majority of people.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to an interview with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party that was conducted by Cornel West.
No, indeed, indeed, because I know the audience titillated to have such a revolutionary atheist with a revolutionary Christian and still have overlap in terms of our love for poor people, and not only that, but a willingness, both of us, to live and die for the cause of trying to change the world and the interests of oppressed people, of those friends for known call the wretched of the earth. But it's so difficult to adjudicate the atheism and the God talk, in the sense of, will there ever be a kind of final agreement between us? Well, that's difficult to envision, because it looks like I'm so rooted in my own understanding of the prophetic tradition and rooted in my own conception of God's love that leads me to want to live and die for poor folk. And yet your life has been exemplary in willingness to pay cost and price and persist and prevail and trying to disclose certain truths objectively and still sustain what I call a revolutionary love for poor people. Is that a fair characterization when I say you have a revolutionary love for poor people?
Well, I think that's part of it, definitely. If you don't have those kind of, you know, if you don't have those kind of feelings, just put it simply, then you cannot be a revolutionary. You cannot be a communist. If you're not outraged at what poor people and people broadly in the world are put through, you know, if that doesn't cause your blood to boil, to put it that way, then you could never be a revolutionary. So in that sense, definitely yes. And if you don't burn with a desire to put an end to that and bring something much better into being, especially when you see that it's possible, then you have absolutely no right to talk about being a revolutionary.
See, that's the kind of fire I'm talking about, and I love that fire. You go back to Black Panther Party. You go back to working with the early Huey Newton. You go back to working with the Revolutionary Union in the Bay Area. You have a long, long, rich history, and yet you've been able to sustain it, to keep alive both your hope as well as your imagination, scientific analysis, that wonderful core with a lot of elasticity, that heart that still has a flexibility, as it were. How do you account for Brother Bob Avakian still being part of this revolutionary love train?
Well, we were talking about this before. If you see the world the way it is and you draw the conclusion you have to draw from being willing to look straight face at the world the way it is, and you recognize that it has not gotten better for the great majority of humanity. It continues to get worse. You know, people are uprooted from one place and desperately searching all over the earth for a way to make a livelihood, trying to go from one country to another just in order to live. You know, they're subjected to wars, they're subjected to environmental destruction, they're subjected to the horror of their own kids being shot down on the street by the police in the hundreds every year in this country. You know, if you see all that, then, and you know that it doesn't have to be that way. Look at all the abundance there is in the world. It's been, in the, you know, the technology, the interconnectedness of people, which could lead to a rich life, and I don't mean financially.
Right.
I mean in what you would call spiritual sense.
Yes.
I mean
yes.
in the enrichment of life, the quality of people's lives. You know, both their material needs, but their intellectual and cultural needs could be met on a whole other level, and yet they're being suffocated and strangled under this system. Why would you want to live under this any longer? Why would you not want to keep working and struggling? And yes, why would you not have an open mind to learn from anyone and anything you could learn from in order to be able to fight better to do this? That's the bedrock of everything. That's, you know, that's where I live, if you want to put it that way, because mm-hmm. I've seen the horror, and I've also seen the fact that it doesn't have to be this way. There have been previous, you know, great breakthroughs that are made in Soviet Union and China to build a whole new socialist society to be on the road of doing away with these things, and they were turned back and defeated. So we've had to study very deeply the lessons to learn how to do better, and, you know, both in fighting, but also in when we get to the stage where we have a new society, how to actually lead that society in an even better way so we can stay on the road and defeat the attempts to crush what we brought into being. So all that goes into it. Why, you know, why would you want to settle for anything less once you see on the one hand what the horror is, but also on the other hand what the possibility for something much different and truly beautiful really is?
I think Americans oftentimes overlook the degree to which communists in our past, though not in any way a large majority, there's always been a small minority of communists in America, but they've played a very important role in struggles against injustice, struggles against white supremacy, male supremacy, struggles against capitalism, struggles against homophobia. We think in the civil rights movement, there are a number of communists that played an important role, going back to the trade union movement. What is the role of revolutionary communists at this particular moment, a kind of an Occupy moment, even though the Occupy movement needs to bounce back? What is the role of communists, and how will revolutionary communists attempt to provide some kind of vision and analysis?
Well, we have a slogan that sort of encapsulates how we approach building a movement for revolution, which is fight the power and transform the people for revolution. And all three parts of that are important. First of all, if people don't rise up against their oppression, if they're just beaten down continually, then they're never going to be able to actually bring a new world into being, and they're never going to be able even to think about the big questions that we're discussing right here of could the world be a different way? Why is it the way it is, and is there a possibility for it to be radically different and better? So people need to be led, and they need to rise up and fight back against the many ways in which people are oppressed, and we need to unite with people when they do rise up. And we need to, at the same time, when we get to transform the people, that means transform the thinking, the consciousness of the people, so they see not just the need to resist this or that outrage, but they see the interconnection of all these different things that outrage people and people rise up against, and they see how they're all rooted in the same capitalist imperialist system and the way that it works and the way that it has to work and the way that it crushes people in working the way it does. And they begin to see at the same time the possibility of a radically different world, because they come to understand that while the system works this way, there is a basis for a whole different kind of system that works on different bases that put the interests of the people forefront and fundamentally, you know, as the basis for what people are doing. So that's transforming the people. It's transforming their thinking, transforming how they relate to each other, transforming what they think is possible, raising their heads so that they can think about the things that normally they're pushed down from even being able to think about. And then, for what? For revolution, because if people don't rise up and fight back, they'll be crushed. But if they just rise up and continually and fight back, they're going to be still trapped in the same situation they're in. I mean, you know, I've said this before, if I were a preacher, you know, and I were looking at all the things going on in the world, you know, just how many times do you have to read about another family whose son or daughter is shot down by the police, and all the tears that flow and the anguish that flows on the basis of that? How many times do you have to have a Romarly Graham or a Manuel Diaz out in California or a Sean Bell or Oscar Grant? How many times do you have that go on? You know, and I don't want to be here, you know, or have someone else be here 30 years from now talking about what we're going to do about the fact that police are shooting people down on the streets in the hundreds every year and subjecting millions of youth to mass incarceration. or women to mass enslavement, or denying them the right to abortion or birth control. I don't want to see a world in which 30 or 40 years from now, we're going over the same outrages talking about what are we going to do about it. We need to move beyond that, so we need a revolution to get to where we can move beyond it.
You're listening to a special broadcast of an interview with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, that was conducted by Cornel West on the Smiley West Show.
One of the fascinating features of the Revolutionary Communist Party is the stress on the arts, music, and on poetry. You've written quite powerfully about the role of imagination. And actually, you put out a little hip-hop single, too. I forget what I remember that as well, come to think of it. But what is the role of the arts when it comes to social activism, struggle, and revolutionary engagement with the world?
Anyway, did I make my point about the preacher? The preacher would say, "How long, O Lord?" But I don't want to keep having to say that, even without the O Lord.
But some preachers say, "How long, O Lord, Lord? I am sent to do something about it."
Okay, there we are.
And we meet in the streets with some revolutionary communists, some anarchists, right, some progressives, and others. But in terms of the arts, though, I just wanted to make clear that we do have that unity,
that we don't want to have to keep saying, how long, even if some of us say, "O Lord," and some of us don't.
That's right.
That's where we meet, that we don't want to have to keep saying that.
That's exactly.
Now, as for the point about, so I just wanted to make that clear. But as far as the point about the arts, yes, because people, you know, I'll invoke your tradition. People do not live by bread alone.
That's right.
People need cultural and intellectual sustenance,
yes,
as well as material sustenance. And people constantly produce art of one kind or another. The question is, what is going to be the content of that, and what is it going to serve? But also, how do we approach different people within different traditions or different fields of art, whether it's painting or music or other things? How do we understand what they're trying to do, and how do we try to give life to things in such a way that it all can contribute to the building up the basis to actually make a revolution, and then to actually have a new society in which culture and art can flourish on a whole other level in many diverse expressions? There isn't just one form of art that should be promoted, and there isn't just art that's political in the more direct and explicit sense that's important. That kind of art, which calls people, you know, to the barricades, to the political struggle, so to speak, you know, using barricades metaphorically.
Right.
Now, let's not distort what's being said here.
That's right.
This point, we're talking about metaphorically, but out in the streets fighting back against the oppression, the art that calls people forward to do that is very important. But there are also many other forms of art, you know, that are more quote-unquote abstract, if you will, or, you know, jazz or other things, which give expression to a mood or a sentiment or a feeling, you know, which also have to be embraced as part of what we're doing. Now, if they have a reactionary content, if they call on people to do things that are harmful to the masses of people, or they create a mood that depresses people and makes them feel that they can't do anything to change their conditions, then we have to get into some struggle about that and say, no, let's have some art and culture. Let's not, you know, let's have hip-hop, but let's not have hip-hop that talks about bitches. Oh, I don't know.
No, that's all
right. Say that on the radio.
The B-word, that's right. No, that's fine.
Okay, bitches and hoes, you know, and
that's right.
Puts women down and just says, I'm going to get mine, and I don't care what happens to anybody else, and if I have to step on or even shoot other people to get rich, let's do that, and I'm just going to promote all kinds of backward nonsense. Let's not have that. Let's have more fight to power, and let's have more let's get rid of oppression, not let's get ours out of this oppression. Not let's get in on it, but let's get rid of it. But, you know, so there has to be struggle about art, but also you have to allow art to flourish and develop. You can't, you know, try to squeeze it, squeeze the life out of it. You can't try to take things as soon as they come forth and put some kind of litmus test to them to see if they measure up in some sort of, you know, abstract and dogmatic sense. You have to have a lot of flourishing of art and culture. This is one of the key things of the new synthesis of communism that I've been bringing forward, that we need to give a lot of emphasis to giving life to these different things, and then we can sift through them. And not just a few of us, but masses of people can sift through them to see what it is that actually inspires them toward things that would really be positive and what is it they need to discard because it actually leads them away from where they need to go. There are a lot of different, you know, yes, I did produce something all played out.
It was a nice single.
But that was just my giving vent, you know, giving expression, not vent, but giving expression to my outrage at a lot of things that go on that get over here, the hypocrisy of the ruling class of this country, and also the backward stuff among the mass of the people, which, yes, does need to be called out. If, you know, we have a saying too, if people are talking, well, I'm going to use the R-rated version here. If people are talking nonsense, you know, they need to be called out for it. Yeah, you know, and that's part of what I was doing there. But, you know, look, I'm not a highly developed, you know, hip hop artist, but there are lots of highly developed hip hop artists. And that's why I say we need more of them doing things that will contribute to the struggle to get rid of oppression in many different forms. It doesn't have to be, let's get rid of oppression, you know, time to stop all the depression. It doesn't have to be like that. But it can be, a lot of different forms in which people, you know, are creating the kind of atmosphere and feeling that inspires people to better things and to stand up and fight back and eventually to make revolution.
No, it's one of the reasons why we talk about Lupe Fiasco and Brother Ali and Erykah Badu and some of the other young artists affecting the generation to come, as it were. Two quick questions. One, of course, is the role of the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex, and the fact that so many of revolutionary communists I know zero in on the deeply racist and unjust criminal justice system. And prisoners themselves seem to be more and more open to at least a broader analysis of the context in which they find themselves. Is this part of the role of trying to engage in transformation society, zeroing in on the prison industrial complex, making sure, like with Michelle Alexander, we have a public discussion about the new Jim Crow?
Well, yes. Look, first of all, once again, to go to the moral dimension, if you will, this is, you know, and the political dimension where they're joined. This is a tremendous outrage. I mean, I think Michelle Alexander has done a tremendous service by systematizing an understanding of what, a huge phenomenon this is and what social role it plays, that this is the new Jim Crow. This is the new segregation and repression directed against black people and also Latinos. But it's part of the whole history of the oppression of black people in this country. And it's an outrage, and it needs to be taken on. There needs to be a massive struggle developed against this in which thousands and ultimately millions of people, and not just black and Latino people, but people everywhere who care about justice and ending injustice, need to become part of this. And from our point of view, we approach this as understanding that this is something very, it gets to something very basic about the whole history of this country and the whole nature of the system in this country, the oppression of black people. And this, so we've taken this up, this new Jim Crow, this mass incarceration. I mean, look what they're doing to the youth. You know, I mean, millions and millions of them being marched off to prison, you know, and being given jackets from the time they're young kids, you know, being rolled up on, stopped and frisked. Four or five are hanging out on the street corner in L.A., and they constitute a gang, which therefore is automatically stripped of its rights. You know, if this were going on in any other country, everybody would say, what a horrific country that is that does something like that to a whole section of people, particularly the youth. So this has to be taken on. From our point of view, this gets to the very nature of this system, and it's one of the fundamental reasons why this system needs to be swept aside. And we've also taken up a mass struggle against the degradation of women in some of the main forms in which patriarchal and male supremacist oppression is coming down on women in the just rampant and vicious and mainstreaming of pornography that's going on, and sexual violence against women, as well as the attacks, the constant incessant attacks, which people like Obama and others are doing nothing to counter, by the way, against the right of women to reproductive freedom, even to have the right to abortion or even birth control in order to be able to determine whether they themselves are going to have children, and if so, when and under what conditions. So this is another thing that gets, it's a mass outrage. There's not enough awareness of it, and there's not enough struggle around it in both these two things. The mass incarceration and the mass degradation of women in these forms, there is not enough awareness, which we need to go out and change, and there's not the kind of mass struggle that there would be, and there should be, and would be, if people understood what is actually going on and what it really represents. And from our point of view, all this is part of building toward getting rid of this system, because all this is rooted in and fundamental to this system. The oppression of black people and other people of color, the oppression of women, you cannot get rid of that under this system, and we need to be rid of it.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to Cornel West's interview with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
Well, I wish we had 2 hours just to be able to sustain this conversation, because I know, again, the internationalism of your vision and of the Revolutionary Communist Party's vision is crucial. So the issues of drones that we highlight, of course, on this show, the bombs dropped on innocent people, connected to the American empire, connected to imperial policies abroad on the one hand, but also, of course, the Wall Street oligarchs control of the economy here on the other. Question that liberals often ask for the kind of conversation we have, which is, does America have the capacity for the kind of revolution that you're calling for? Wouldn't there first be a fascist revolution before there's a communist revolution? So there's more right-wing of soil in the country. So if you actually had a clash, it'd be more fascist than communist, and therefore the liberals say, you better hold on for the middle ground, because we're the only thing standing between poor people and fascism. What do you say to such a
Well, I think that, on the one hand, that is a real danger.
Yes.
And there is a real fascist movement in this country, and it has connections up to the highest levels of government in the Republican Party. It has backing from powerful forces within the ruling class of this country. So that's a real thing and shouldn't be ignored or underestimated. But the answer to it is not to try to, quote-unquote, hold on to the middle ground, because the middle ground keeps getting shifted and dragged more and more to the right, so that the liberals start finding themselves compromising more and more with fascism in order to hold off fascism. And that is a recipe or a formula for disaster. What has to happen is we have to bring forward the force of people who suffer the most under this system and have the most reason to rise up against it, but also other people throughout the middle class and others, including the students, including the people in the intelligentsia, professionals and others, who may not yet be convinced of the need for revolution or may not feel that their life calls out for it in the same urgent way that people on the bottom of this society who catch hell, if you I want to use another metaphor like that, catch hell every day.
That's Malcolm. That's Malcolm X right there.
Right, that is. I openly acknowledge my debt to Malcolm on that one.
Prophetic Muslim. Yeah, no, right here.
Yeah, I openly acknowledge that debt, yes. Catch hell every day under the system.
Right.
But, you know, there's also people in the middle class who may not be in that position, but who are outraged by a lot of the injustices and the things you're talking about, the wars, the environmental destruction, the use of the drones, which could kill, hundreds, if not thousands of civilians already in countries, on different continents already now. The bombing of Libya, which more people should have been outraged by, the U.S. and NATO bombing of Libya. But, the wars that have continued in Afghanistan and other places, there are many people who are upset about these things. But as long as they hold on to the notion that we better not say a peep about them because we might encourage the fascists, they're just going to allow things to get worse and worse. And then we could find ourselves in a situation where the form of rule over the people takes on an overtly and directly terroristic, fascistic form. But what's going on? Two things. We're not going to stop that by conciliating with it and by trying to rely on other sections of the ruling class, which are not going to resist it in the way it needs to be resisted, because they are representatives of the same system, and they have to work out their compromises with these fascist forces who are also part of the ruling structure. And second of all, the answer to it is revolution. The answer is not trying to preserve this system in some kind of form that would be a little less horrible than fascism.
Mm-hmm. Which groups in American society do you think would be most open to your message of revolutionary change?
Look, we have to look, who are the people that, again, we'll invoke Malcolm, who are the people who are catching hell the hardest ways under this system every day? The people, not in the more bourgeois strata, but the basic masses of people among black people, Latinos, and others in the inner city, and other poor people in the country, and people who have had a better life or have had a little bit higher standard of living, maybe unionized workers, who are now being driven down, you know, and losing some of that. But the basic bedrock of revolution, as we say it, are the people who are, you know, have the foot on them the hardest and who are in conditions of poverty and brutality as a result of the workings of the system and as a result of how the system is enforced over them. Those are the people who have the most fundamental and driving interest in changing things radically, and they just need to be convinced of the possibility of doing that, and that's what we're working to do. And they need to be they need to have their consciousness transformed to see the full picture of this system and its horrors, not just what it does to them, but what it does to people in all different parts of society, and even worse, to people in other parts of the world, especially what's called the third world. But that's going to be the bedrock and driving force. And then on that basis, we have to go out and unite much broader forces, as I said earlier, among the students, among the intelligentsia more generally, you know, among the middle class, certainly among women who are oppressed under this system, among gay people and others who are oppressed under this system. We have to go out and build what we call a broad united front, but under the leadership of the proletariat, that is the exploited class in this society on whose backs the whole system is built.
Yes, indeed. Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice. That is the voice of my dear brother, legendary leftist, legendary lover of poor and oppressed people, legendary chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Ovakian. Thank you so very much. I hope you have unsettled many in our audience, because we need to hear voices from across the board wrestling with the issues of poverty, militarism, empire, male supremacy, homophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Arab, anti-Islamic sensibility. Why? Because of a love of humanity. Thank you so very much, my brother.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
All right, what you've been listening to is a rebroadcast of an interview done by Cornel West with Bob Ovakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And I want to thank very much Public Radio International and the Smiley and West Show for giving us permission to rebroadcast that interview. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Jason Kowalski from the policy director of 350.org, and we're going to be talking about climate change and their upcoming Do the Math tour. So stay tuned. Welcome back, and that is Dr. John with Revolution. That's kind of the theme all the way through this show today. The music, the whole idea, and I'll talk about that at the end of the show. There's something we all got to get out of this, especially coming up after all this craziness that's been going on. All right, well, if you're like me, you've been and you've kept your eyes open, and you've been listening, and you've been reading, and you've just been living in the world as a sentient human being, as someone who's actually paying attention to what's going on around them and what's being done around them and what's being done to the people of the world and what's being done to the planet, you must be clearly very, very, very disturbed, okay, at the very least. And our next guest is Jason Kowalski. He's the policy director of 350.org. And 350.org has launched, I think it's beginning either now or has just begun or it will begin in a day or two or whatever. He is part of an organization that's doing a tour called the Do the Math Tour, which is touring, I think, 21 cities in 25 days. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, listen, man, before we get into the tour, although, actually, tell us a little bit about 350.org. What is this organization?
Well, I suppose it's a bit of a funny name, naming yourself after a number, but 350 stands for the safe upper limit of carbon in the atmosphere. Climate change isn't about politics and who's right or who's wrong. It's about math a lot of the time. So 350 represents the safe upper limit of carbon in the atmosphere, and currently we're at 392. So we'd like to decarbonize our economy and get back to 350 in order to stop climate change.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, just I won't take it personal, but, you know, I always wished that my mother had named me something like 9. You know, it would have been much easier. So I have no problem with the name of your organization. Anyway, let's talk about this because, you know, people right away, people will point to the hurricane at Sandy that just, you know, hit the East Coast and other, you know, places in the Caribbean and devastated many, many lives, killed a lot of people. I mean, just horrifying what happened there. And people, all of a sudden, there's some sense of, well, there's something going on with the climate. And, you know, one of the things that I was reading, and it's interesting, too, because I noticed that Bill McKibben, who is part of your tour and part of your organization, has actually, in his piece that he did in Rolling Stone, that piece became the most widely read piece ever in the history of Rolling Stone. And I think those are all very good signs. But for people who are just looking at things and thinking, well, you know, I can stick my hand out the car window and it doesn't fry, you know, is this stuff real? I wanted to actually get you to talk a little bit about what is the situation today? What is just give people a broad picture, and then we'll get into some particulars around the numbers. But what is the broad picture of what's happening in the climate today?
That's a great question. You know, for decades, scientists have been really puzzled by the fact that the public isn't motivated by line graphs. And, you know, it's taken a few real-world examples for people to really connect the dots and wake up and say, oh, this is climate change, right? I mean, Katrina was a huge disaster, and that woke a few folks up. You know, we've had slideshows from former vice presidents. We've had droughts. We've had wildfires. I think Sandy, you know, really brought this home to a lot of folks. There's a, you know, really dense population on the East Coast, and I think people, you know, it wasn't just Sandy. It was the fact that we had droughts and wildfires all summer. We had freak storms. We had crazy weather extremes, you know, from freak blizzards to record downpours and rainfall. People get that something's wrong with the weather. And folks are beginning to connect the dots. And, you know, it's a fascinating story because it's more than just weather and temperature. It's also about politics. It's about how fossil fuel industry has systematically corrupted our political system to favor their out-of-date business model that's wrecking the climate. And people are realizing that this is it's not just about science anymore. It's a moral issue. It has to do with protecting the most vulnerable in our country and around the world. It has to do with corrupt industries that are running the show at our expense. And people are ready to do something about it. And that's what 350 is all about, and that's what this tour is about, is spreading the word and getting people involved, letting them take control of our climate and of our energy destiny in this country.
Well, let's talk about this. It's called the Do the Math Tour. Where did the name come from? And then we'll get into talking about the math. In particular, I wanted to approach things a little bit the way Bill McKibben did in his article and talk about those three very critical numbers, numbers that it's critical for people to understand. So first off, what's the Do the Math Tour? Why the name?
Great question. Well, no one likes doing math, as people often point out. But, you know, this is the crux of climate change, right, is that the math just doesn't fit business as usual. We can't keep running our economy on oil and coal the way we have been and expect climate change to just go away. What the climate science tells us is that we have, I'll just summarize it at first, we have 5 times more carbon in the ground claimed by our energy companies than we can safely burn. That's what the science suggests. If you look at the amount of climate change that the scientists say we can bear before we have this runaway, you know, stream of disasters and we don't want to go any further, they say that we can warm the Earth about 2 degrees, right? That's the first number you mentioned. So far, we've put enough carbon in the atmosphere to warm it about, you know, a little bit more than 1 degree, but we're well on our way to 2. And the only way to avoid that is to only burn some of the carbon we've identified, you know, by oil companies and coal companies and their reserves and whatnot. And if you look at the number, the amount of total reserves on the planet, you get about 25,000 gigatons of carbon reserves and all the oil, coal, and natural gas that different energy companies have found underground. And then if you look at the amount that scientists say we can burn, you're only at 500 gigatons of oil, coal, and natural gas. So basically, we need to tell, we need policies globally that make it so that we can only burn 20% of the carbon that we've identified in reserves, oil by oil companies, coal companies, and natural gas. That means 80% of it has to be left in the ground. And that's some pretty startling math. So that's what the tour is about.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking now with Jason Kowalski, Policy Director of 350.org, about climate change and the Do the Math Tour that's currently traveling across the country and beating the drum and warning, blowing bugles and warning, waking people up and talking about we got to do something about this. Now, Jason, tell me this. You know, one of the things when you were mentioning all these, you know, the reserves that are in the ground and what we have, you know, it's kind of interesting to me because and very revealing because, you know, I think it's not so much corruption, but we live in a system that actually everything you can. And I notice, you know that these people, the heads of these, you know, fuel companies and all these other things are out there, and they're looking at the reserves that are in the ground, and they're not saying, they're not like looking at that and then looking at the scientific evidence and saying, okay, but we can only burn this much more, put this much more carbon in the air, so we better back off. Instead, they're looking at it as, and I thought this is really, really very important, they're looking at it as this, what's in the ground, we have a mad scramble to get this and to basically make profit off of it. And they, even before they take it out of the ground, they are actually planning on burning it because that's what gives value to their companies.
You're right. It's fascinating. I mean, the way we look at it, it's like the fossil fuel industry has become a rogue industry, right? You know, it's not like a nuclear power plant where something needs to go wrong for there to be a catastrophe. Their business model is entirely, the whole plan is to wreck the planet. That's what will happen if they dig up all the reserves and burn them. And you're right, it's fascinating the way it's already linked up with the global financial system. Some economists have called this the carbon bubble, right? The idea that, you know, every investor looks at these pools of carbon and says, oh yeah, we can burn that. Let's invest in this, when really we all know that we can't invest in this. And governments internationally have agreed that they can't invest in this because we can't let runaway climate catastrophe just keep going.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get into this and let's talk about three of these numbers, and you've started to hit on all of them. First, you mentioned 2 degrees Celsius. What's up with that number?
So 2 degrees is the tipping point at which we can't stop climate change anymore. Some scientists call this runaway climate change. This is the point where there's so much carbon in the atmosphere that the Earth's weather, the Earth's climate is fundamentally different than the environment in which humanity has evolved. This is the point at which we have mass species extinction, we're moving our coastal cities inland, and civilization is in a much different place.
Mm-hmm. And where are we at now?
We're a little bit above 1 degree. If we continue burning carbon at the rate that we're burning it, we'll eclipse 2 degrees with 16 more years of carbon combustion at current rates.
16 more years. And what are you saying is going to happen in 16 more years if we continue along the rate it's going?
It'll be past a point of no return. The average carbon molecule, once you burn your gas in your car and it goes into the air, it stays there. It stays in the upper atmosphere for 100 years on average. So a lot of the climate change we're experiencing now is from over 100 years of carbon going into the atmosphere. So every bit of inaction that time we waste now, letting the fossil fuel companies run the show, will impact generations for years to come.
Yeah, and I read that James Hansen has said that the target that's being talked about in all this for 2 degrees of warming, that actually that in its own right, well, that's the limit. That in its own right is actually a prescription for long-term disaster.
That's true.
Doesn't worry you, huh? Worries the hell out of me, man. Boy, that's just so mind-boggling. It's terrifying and it's enraging.
You know, it's that's the point. And I hope there's a lot more people getting enraged about this, just talking about it. I want to remind listeners that we're talking with Jason Kowalski, who's the policy director of 350.org, about climate change, about global warming, and about the 350.org's Do the Math Tour, which we're going to talk about in just a few minutes. But I wanted to get to these other numbers. Jason, there's another number, and that's 565 gigatons. Tell us about that.
That's right. So we talked about 2 degrees. We talked about how that's the safe upper limit in terms of temperature increases due to carbon in the atmosphere. The next number you mentioned is the amount of, it's like our carbon allowance. That's the amount of carbon we're allowed to release into the atmosphere before we hit that scary tipping point number. So if you look at industrial societies around the world, you'd think that they'd see the science and come together and say, okay, this means that we can only burn this much carbon, and we're all going to make a rule to only do that much. That way we don't have runaway climate change. And they shake hands, and that's it. Unfortunately, that's not how international climate policy works. Every country says, no, I'm not going to go first, especially the U.S., and the fossil fuel companies are running the show. They want to dig up as much carbon as possible, as quickly as possible, and make enough money as much money as possible before folks in countries like the U.S. wake up to the dangers.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting when you're saying things like that. It's you know, McKibben makes the point that virtually, if you're looking at any of these conferences and you're looking at all these various initiatives that have been put out by various governments around the world, that when you boil it all down, when you clear up all the fog around it, that actually comes down to it, they haven't done a damn thing. And in some cases, including when you look at what's been done under Obama around the things of opening up drilling in the Arctic Ocean, after the Deepwater Horizon, the BP oil crisis and all this stuff, they've actually increased the number of deepwater oil drilling going on in the Gulf of Mexico, the fracking, the pipelines. They're actually going at it full speed ahead. It's like, to hell with all this science. Science, schmience. When we fry an egg on the sidewalk, I'll pay attention. But until that, all out for the money. This is just outrageous.
Right. And this is why we're doing this tour. And this is why we think of this in terms of social movements, right? We know that the science isn't enough. People aren't motivated enough by PowerPoints and line graphs. And we need to take it beyond science and into the streets. That's why we're doing this tour and going city to city. That's why we're attracting thousands of people who are coming and seeing this shocking new math and ready to take action about it. And, what we need to do in this country is really understand that the fossil fuel industries, big oil, big coal, are rogue industries. Right now, they have a social license to just keep doing what they're doing. We need to do to them what we did to big tobacco decades before, where we look at every single ad from Exxon or Shell and say, yep, they're trying to ruin the planet, and that needs to stop. And until that happens, business as usual means blowing past this 2-degree limit and accepting climate change as our fate.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the tour. Where is it going? What's it going to do? And how are you going to actually do this thing about into the streets?
Great question. So the tour right now is Bill's actually in a biodiesel bus going through the mountains just south of Shasta right now in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. And, the plan, somebody was telling me they were talking to you yesterday, I think, and they said that you had talked about when the tour actually ends up, it's going to end up in Washington, D.C., and you have a plan for something after that?
That's right. As soon as the election results came in, we said, great, on to the next thing. Elections are important, but we all know we need to hold our leaders accountable. And you mentioned that, be it Obama or Romney, both of them are talking about how much fossil fuel they can dig up out of the ground and how quickly. One of the big tests for our newly elected president will be whether or not he approves this controversial tar sands pipeline called Keystone XL. That's basically a straw dipped into this massive carbon bomb in Canada and bringing this especially dirty oil sand into the U.S. to be burned. This is one of these reserves of, we think of it as untouchable carbon reserves, where if we start digging into it, we're basically accepting that runaway climate change is going to come eventually, and we're giving up. So one climate scientist has called the Keystone XL pipeline game over for climate change. And so when we get to D.C., we're going to talk about the math. We're going to bring thousands of people into a theater downtown. But as soon as we're done talking about the math, we're going to bring some action directly to the White House, and we're going to carry a 500-foot-long inflatable pipeline to Obama's front yard, and we're going to let him know how we feel. We're happy he's elected. We're happy he's ready to talk about climate change and protect us from a warming world, but test number one is whether or not he denies the Keystone pipeline.
Well, I'll tell you, Jason, it's one place where I would disagree with you. I think actually the one thing here we got to really recognize is that cat, anybody who would then do what he's done with the Deepwater Horizon and the drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, who would do what he's done with that big coal reserve, and where was it, Wyoming, if he would do what he's done with the Arctic. I mean, this is the Arctic Ocean. Good Lord, come on. or to see the melting of the polar ice, the Arctic ice, to be an opportunity to get more oil or fight over who's going to get that carbon fuel under there. I think people got to really examine things. Look for truth in what people are doing, as well as what they may say, you know, and act on that basis. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, this is also modeled after divestment, right? The whole anti-apartheid divestment campaign.
That's right. The Do the Math Tour is going to be really focused on getting college students involved in this movement. The divestment campaign you mentioned that stopped apartheid divested college endowment money from South Africa, which sent a message to the apartheid regime that they needed to stop their human rights abuses there in South Africa. And, you know, we think the same tactic could work really well for the fossil fuel industry. A lot of campuses are doing the right thing. They're, you know, cutting carbon on their campuses. They have great environmental studies departments. But a lot of the money that funds that great education is invested in companies like Exxon and Shell and coal companies that are ready to blow past this 2-degree limit and usher in a warmed world beyond the one that we've experienced for the last few millennia. Mm-hmm. And that's got to stop. When we think that divestment from the fossil fuel industry from endowments can help reel back that social license we were talking about earlier, where the fossil fuel companies are seen as just normal companies.
All right, Jason.
They're a rogue industry, and we need to divest from them.
All right, Jason, we have to wrap up on that point. But before we go, give people the site again that they can find out more information about the tour.
That's right, math.350.org.
All right, Jason, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Take care now. Bye now. All right, I'm Michael Slate. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And just if you've gotten anything out of this show, out of this last conversation, and out of this show as a whole, I hope it's along these two points, that there is nothing more unrealistic than the idea of reforming the system into something that would come anywhere near being in the interest of the great majority of people and ultimately humanity as a whole. And remember, what I hope you get out of this is the understanding not only that the world as it is a horror, but it doesn't have to be that way. And that's because of the work that Bob Avakian's done over several decades, summing up both the positive and the negative experience of communist revolution so far and drawing from a whole range of human experience. He's developed a whole new synthesis of communism that has opened the door to a reality that is viable. It's a viable vision, and he has a strategy for a radically new and much better society and world, and he's providing the leadership that we need to get there, to carry forward the struggle toward that goal. So check that out. I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And now let's go out with Chrissy Hynde and the Pretenders and Revolution.
Cats like me and you have got laws that they adhere to. Laws outside the laws, as they down by the